Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, live from Wimbledon on day 10 of the championships, which have just seen our semi-final lineup set. I'm Catherine Whittaker, Matt's here. Hello, Matt.
Hello, and the rain is here.
We didn't plan for it. We're very committed to the dry weather position, so we're just going to have to see how it goes. David's here in a waterproof jacket.
Yeah.
You've sorted yourself out, David. Don't worry about us.
I did bring you an umbrella, but yes, you're right. I don't really care about Matt, so that's okay.
And Charlie Eccleshare of The Athletic is here. Charlie, nice to see you. You learnt from Simon Briggs' shorts mistake yesterday.
Yeah, I honestly was watching that and I felt cold. And I wore shorts myself yesterday, so no judgment. But I was like, yeah, I'm really glad I got that memo that it's colder up here.
We're particularly touched that you're here with us today, because right at this moment, on number one court, Thomas Enqvist and Ann Gjothervong are playing a Legends mixed invitational doubles against Conchita Martinez and Greg Rusedski.
Wow.
And Charlie, you're a big Greg guy.
I was growing up, yeah.
Was.
That was brutal.
Well, as in when he was still playing top flight tennis. I got into tennis late 90s. 97 was like a big year for me in tennis, and he got to the US Open final, obviously. And then I remember just watching like loads of indoor events after that, which, David, you'll remember. There was one, do you remember he was two sets up against Ivan Isevich at Basel? And lost?
Yes.
I was big into Greg then.
Look,
yeah.
You don't know what level tennis he's playing.
True.
Because you're not watching.
Yeah.
Who knows what's going on number one court right now with Conchita? It's been an awesome day of tennis, I think, and perhaps awesome in places that we weren't quite expecting it. None of the matches were duffers today, but I think the match of the day, I mean, Medvedev Eubanks could probably make a play for match of the day. I saw less of that. I was in a multi-screen situation on centre court, unfortunately watching that with the sound off, which means I don't know what Daniel Medvedev was saying to Damien Dumoussoir, but luckily David was in the court one commentary box, best possible seat in the house, and you can tell us everything. But I think the match of the day was Ons Jabeur against Elena Rybakina, and the revenge storyline for Ons Jabeur.
Yeah, well, she certainly wasn't backing off from that narrative, was she? She talked about wanting revenge in her previous on-court interview. And I thought she was fantastic today. I think mentally as well as in her game, she really held it in today, that game. She, for the most part, put the drop shots away and the trick shots and all the things she's capable of doing and just played really solid tennis and tried to go toe-to-toe. And she served for the opening set and failed to serve it out. Rybakina just sort of wrestled that from her. And then when it went into a tiebreak and Rybakina won that tiebreak, I mean, I think it's a major achievement from Jabeur that she didn't fold. It would have been really easy to after losing two Grand Slam finals last year. You could easily go into a kind of woe is me, it's never my day, and she wasn't having any of that. She just sort of got it back and was deserving of that win.
I'm somebody that when she lost that tiebreak and showed the frustration that she did, not just upon losing that tiebreak, but actually before she lost it, midway through that tiebreak, when she went the mini break down, she showed so much frustration. I was worried about that. I was really worried about her after that opening set, and Well, I can see your smug face, David. We will come on to we will come on to your big prediction in a moment. Matt, first your thoughts.
I thought the second half of that match was maybe the best tennis I've ever seen Ons Jabeur play. She was breakpoints down in that second set, I think at 2-all, serving 15-40 after dropping that first set. She managed to hold and get out of that game. And afterwards, she was just absolutely awesome. And I am genuinely really interested to hear David's thoughts, because even at that point, David was saying he felt like Ons Jabeur was going to turn this match around. And I personally was thinking, I don't know, I feel like Rybakina with the first set in the bag will probably go on to win this. I think Rybakina's serve definitely dropped off as the match went on. Her percentage fell, and also she wasn't hitting her spots quite so well. But Ons Jabeur was leaning on it, and the backhand return in particular to then set up these forehands from Ons Jabeur was absolutely incredible. As David said, it wasn't the usual Ons Jabeur that we see. There weren't that many drop shots. It was just sort of line-licking winners for a set and a half there, and I thought she was just in the zone. And she basically said to Rybakina, okay, you want to hit powerful shots? I'm ready for those powerful shots. I will turn them back on you and hit them for winners. And to do that from a set down against the player that caused her such heartache in the Wimbledon final last year, there was a lot going on in Jabeur's head today, and she managed it so well. And yeah, this is a little revenge tour that she's on, because she'd lost to Petra Kvitova at Wimbledon before. She'd lost and beaten her here. She'd lost to Rybakina, of course, last year, now beaten her. And she's also lost to her next opponent at Wimbledon in the past. So yeah, revenge tour, and love to see it.
Now, David, I joke about your smugness, but actually I think you're being fantastically restrained, because the message that you sent when Ons Jabeur lost that opening set on the tiebreak, I greeted it with a scoff. Quite frankly, I was concerned that would be a landslide of a second set for Elena Rybakina after Jabeur lost that first. I was really worried for her. I absolutely did not see coming what you absolutely saw coming. You came in with the hot take of all hot takes.
2 points into the set.
And it was...
Honestly, it was...
a triumph.
Mm. Well, look, there's a few things. The first thing is, the reason I thought she would win before the match, one was that she'd beaten Kvitova, which I just thought is a similar type of foe, really. Mm. Okay, different angles, but it's a similar trajectory of ball coming your way. So she's just handled that for the loss of three games. And I know that Kvitova didn't play well, but she got really bamboozled by Jabeur. The other reason was the health of Rybakina. I know she's looked good, but she'd also played Katie Bolter, who isn't at that level, right? She's a decent player, but she's nowhere near the level of these players. And that, I'm not dissing her by saying that. She's just not. Maybe one day she will be, but she certainly isn't at the moment. So that's 6-1, 6-1, and in 56 minutes. And then she's had a player retire against her at 4-1. So she's not had much tennis in the last couple of rounds. She's not match tough. And who knows how much she's got in the tank, really, if it goes deep. And that's why I thought it'd be three sets, I would favour Jabeur, right? The other thing that occurred to me, it only started to occur to me during the first set, is it just reminded me of sitting in the same seat during Ons Jabeur against Garbiñe Muguruza 2 years ago. And it's the first time I ever saw Jabeur and thought, we have a top player on our hands here, because she's facing Muguruza in form, who's won two Grand Slam titles, finally looking like herself again, and she turned that around from a set down 5-7, 6-3, 6-2, and it was very similar scoreline in the end to this. And it just, I remember sitting next to Annabelle Croft in that match doing the commentary, and we were both drunk on watching Ons Jabeur that day. It was one of those days that just makes you a fan. And I thought, well, again, Muguruza's got a similar type of game to Rybakina. So I believe that she's got this in her. And look, some days it goes your way.
Just so Dave doesn't have a complete monopoly on smugness.
I mean, I'm sorry. Who's invited him?
I did say yesterday I thought Jabeur would go on and win the title.
Why?
Mainly, she hasn't done.
Yeah, exactly. Just get that in before
David's
she goes out tomorrow.
Very short term with his predictions. Yeah. That's the truth. Yeah.
David has said in the past that Ons Jabeur won't be in a mix in a Grand Slam in his lifetime.
I have said that.
Not that long ago.
I really hope you're going to make it to the weekend.
If you go
David.
In the archives enough, there's something to make me look a fool in every couple of months.
Why? I mean, it was a partly fairly an arbitrary call, I'll admit. But I do think you guys were talking about it. I can't remember if it was before the tournament, but that she's not being spoken about necessarily as a big favourite. Whereas last year, it did feel like she herself was kind of cultivating that pressure as though she was one of the big favourites. I feel she's gone under the radar a little bit. And sometimes with players going for their first Grand Slam, you just get a sense that it's their time. Obviously, this would be her third Grand Slam final. I don't know. I feel like she should have used those experiences. I just think she's coming through, seems to be peaking at just the right time. But look, we'll see. I mean, tomorrow's going to be so interesting, that match. Really looking forward to that. But yeah, I think she's got a good shot.
There was some Djokovician defiance about her, wasn't there, after losing that first set? It was, no, not again, not today. This is not happening. I won't let it happen again, I won't go through that again. It was, I loved watching Ons Jabeur in that mode. And there's been some great tennis from Elena Rybakina this fortnight, but the baked-in confidence, the resistance wasn't quite there, was it? And of course, now, looking back, that makes total sense. She came in beyond undercooked and perhaps did well to get to this point. But I'm glad she did. She's the first defending women's champion to reach the quarterfinals the following year since 2016 when Serena
really?
Did it.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, so that's a good effort from her and just confirms that she's here to stay at the top of the game. And I still believe in a big three. It might be a big four by the end of the week. TBC on that, but I do believe in the big three.
Bobo Krejcikova or Onsova?
We've hinted at it, but it will be Arina Sabalenka that Ons Jabeur faces in the semi-finals tomorrow. She beat Madison Keys in two straight sets. Little moment of jeopardy here in the opening stages of the second set when Keys went a break up. Did it ever really feel like jeopardy, though?
I felt like this match was kind of the story of Madison Keys' career and the story of Arina Sabalenka's season. You know, it was Madison Keys getting through to the, you know, big stage in a Grand Slam. Once again, she's reached so many quarterfinals. And coming up against a player in Arina Sabalenka who is different in 2023. First set, Sabalenka was really picking on the Keys' backhand. The backhand was making an awful lot of errors. I think David described it last night really, really well in terms of old power and new power. And just felt like Sabalenka hit the bigger ball and was able to rush Keys and draw errors, and she was awesome in that set. But Keys really, to her credit, fought really well at the start of the second set and went to break up 4-2, 40 love she's up in that second set. And that's the point where I'm thinking that it sort of tells you all you need to know about both players, because I don't think Keys sort of completely went off the boil. I don't think it was a choke, but she didn't stamp her authority on it. She didn't close it. And Sabalenka, just a couple of years ago, I think, loses that game, loses the set and goes a breakdown in the third. And yet now she just has an ability to stop momentum going against her and turn it back around. And she won 11 points in a row after that and closed out the match really, really impressively.
It was like she went, oh, you've started playing better, have you? I'll just play a bit better then. Here you go. And the calmness with which she delivers that surge now it's unrecognisable from the player she used to be. I know this isn't her first Wimbledon semi-final. She reached this stage 2 years ago, lost out to Karolina Pliskova. But she's just a completely different player, I think, to the one that reached the last one.
Yeah, definitely. And I think someone like Keys does it very one-dimensional. And Sabalenka, maybe that was an accusation that you would have levelled against her previously. But, I mean, look, a lot of the time she does just do plan A, but better, and that's fine. But I think today she did have to find something different. And yeah, just on keys, I mean, she I think that is what holds her back. I just don't think she's got enough variety, you know. And that will get, I think that's the thing, that will get you to quarterfinals. And she's, as you say, she's done that so many times, but then making that extra step. And I think she's 28 now, so I don't know how many more opportunities she'll have. She's been spoken about so often as a threat on the grass, and she is. And, you know, she's won 3 grass court titles, including one just coming into Wimbledon. But, yeah, I think just got a little bit exposed today.
Okay, so seeing as we have our prophetic tennis analysts with us, and Matt, who's done the analysis of the Ange Jabeur Revenge Tour, what's going to happen tomorrow? Jabeur against Sabalenka?
I haven't really thought about that yet.
Well, it was quite...
Well, Charlie's thought about it in the macro sense. Obviously, if you predicted Jabeur to win the title yesterday, you must still be predicting that.
Very much so. I made an arbitrary call and I'm going to resolutely stick to it.
Welcome to the tennis podcast, yeah. Charlie.
It was quite interesting hearing Rybakina after the match talk about how for her... the physics of the match were difficult, was the word she used. Having to get so low to deal with Ons Jabeur's ball, not necessarily the slice or the drop shots, because we didn't see too many of those, but just that flat trajectory, I think, was quite difficult for her. And
did you intervene to give her tips? Matt loves a low ball.
Oh, I do, yeah.
This is really well timed, because I've done a piece about playing on grass and the difficulties, and part of it is about how low you need to get. That's one of the hardest things for players to do.
Yeah, I think there's a assumption that grass would be a really good surface for Riley Opelka or John Isner,
exactly, yeah.
David Law.
With their serve, yeah. David Law. But actually, no. Having to get so low is difficult. You're tall, that's what we're saying.
Yeah, but supple. I think I'd be good on grass.
Has anyone ever described David as supple?
I'll tell you.
How did Andy Roddick describe you?
He described me as... I can't remember now.
No, I can't either. Sorry, I've put you on the spot.
It wasn't hugely complimentary. No. It wasn't supple.
He was trying to hype or subtle. He was trying to hype up Law against Whittaker in 2014 when we played each other at the Royal Albert Hall in our one and only ever match. And he said, you've got to make him move. He doesn't strike me as a gazelle. That's what he said.
And I listened and it was successful.
Funnily enough,
Andy.
The word Tsitsipas used to describe himself in my interview with him before the tournament. Like, on clay, exclusively on clay. Yeah.
Wasn't it a gazelle in the
desert? Which I had to look up, because that struck me as jarring. I don't think of gazelles as desert, but there are some.
A Tsitsipas comment struck you as jarring, Charlie.
Shocking.
Would you believe it?
You had to fact check it. Wow.
But on that matter, I mean, Radvanska obviously being someone that was cited to me, who was amazing at getting so low, and obviously she reached a final here.
And I think Sabalenka is better at that than Rybakina. There was quite a lot of... almost Radvanska-esque, Kerber-esque sort of crouch shots from Sabalenka today. I think she's maybe a better athlete overall than Rybakina. I mean, not that Rybakina's a bad one, but Sabalenka is such a force on a tennis court. And she does lead that head-to-head, including a win at Wimbledon. I guess I would stick with Sabalenka. Went with her pre-tournament. She's still in.
You've made an arbitrary prediction. Yeah. Exactly. You're going to resolutely stick to it.
Sometimes, though, I think you can go through a tournament and feel something
and change
or
your
see
mind.
Something that makes you feel differently. Obviously, an
especially
injury
especially if you
happen.
Predicted Kvitova pre-tournament and you've got an opening.
And Świątek. But anyway.
Who's filling your opening?
Well, look, I mean, we should add that the newsletter will contain our actual final predictions tomorrow in set scores. But as we sit here right now, I'm going Jabeur. Yeah.
Thank you, David.
I will never ignore a David Laurence Jabeur prediction ever again.
She does make you feel things. And that can sometimes be problematic,
imagine the emotions of a Jabeur-Svitolina final.
I think we're going to get that.
Yeah, I was going to say, to what extent do we think whoever wins that semi-final, the Jabeur-Sabalenka one, will win it? Because that's where I'm at. But maybe that's being unfair on the other one.
I think they're the favourite to win it, certainly. I think Svitolina will make the final, and I think she has a chance. This is something we discussed last night. Is Svitolina in the mix? Can she win it? Yes, I think she can. But I think the winner of Jabeur-Sabalenka is the favourite, regardless of who comes through the other semi-final.
Just imagine if Vondrousova just comes out and plays four stone cold sets.
Well, I think she'll win. I think she'll win tomorrow, Vondrousova. I'm quite confident on that. I don't fully know why, but I don't know. Okay. There's something.
So many unsolicited arbitrary predictions.
He's been saving them up for you.
Yeah, exactly. I've got loads more. Yeah.
What's that? What's the feeling? Is it a game thing, or is it a potential risk of emotional hitting a wall?
Yeah, I just feel like she's playing a bit with house money at this point. She's had such a good run. There's no pressure.
Are they not both, though? Svitolina's a wild card.
I know, but I feel like now Svitolina has got the whole of Wimbledon behind her. Everyone's rooting for her, which is huge, and that's a boost. But I also think sometimes you have these fairy tale runs, and then it gets to a point like a semi or a final, and the emotional investment that you have to put in. You know, think what this tournament must have been like for Svitolina. I just think at some point there's going to be a flatness, and I think that will be tomorrow.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or your smart TV, both in HD. Matt, this sounds like your kind of thing.
Yeah, there's nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere, dipping in to where there's the latest final set tiebreak or even the latest bit of aggro.
And David, don't worry, you can just watch your favourite court, Suzanne Longlen, all day if you want. But whatever you choose, the French Open promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history.
Do you know, I think in a lot of ways, the French Open is now my favourite slam. It's the strategy of the clay court tennis, the way it challenges players, and particularly now with legends of the game up against a new generation of young players. I cannot wait.
Be there when it happens, with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Subscribe to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription. We had Simon Briggs, formerly your colleague at the Telegraph, on yesterday. Obviously, you're now at the Athletic, and his take was, you know, he's got two brains, hasn't he? He's got tennis fan brain, and he's got what's best for my
what he wants to happen
star rating brain. And quite frankly, you know, the best thing for his career success is a Sabalenka Svitolina final, mm-hmm. because of the news line that brings, Belarus, Ukraine, everything that goes with it. Make of that what you will, is just a fact. Obviously, the Athletic's angle on things is a little bit different. What's the dream final for you?
I think that would be, because ultimately for us as well, it's what's the biggest story? What gets people most interested? What has cut through? And that absolutely would. Again, I mean, with two brains, I guess there are two audiences. There's the sort of core tennis who really want to know about forehands and backhands, but then there's the other big audience as well, which is just what an amazing story on a human level.
Would be extraordinary, wouldn't it?
Do you get a sense of the relative sizes of those audiences?
What I would say is, for us, for instance, the story that's gone nuts over the past couple of weeks is one we did about Wimbledon changing the all-white rule because of periods. And I think that just had such a wide appeal, because it's something that, you know, half the world's population can relate to. So I think that those stories, I think the ones that will really go crazy are probably those ones. But on a more consistent basis, yeah, that they're the sort of core tennis fan. That I don't know. It's probably about 50-50.
Interesting.
But I think tennis is that kind of sport. I think there are just topics that really grab people. Unlike a lot of other, you know, things like scheduling, even people can kind of relate to that, or rain, you know, rain delays. Weather is something that everyone can kind of latch onto. So yeah, it's kind of juggling those two things.
I think we're in a, and this applies to the men's as well, I think we're in a really good place at this stage of the tournament. I think all scenarios are good. Look, Vondroušová is kind of the weakest link, isn't she, in terms of story. I would find it incredibly funny if she reached the Wimbledon final. I love her style of play, but maybe in terms of cut through and everything, she's the weak link. But basically, I think we're in a really great place.
Agreed.
Just nodding. Well, I suppose nodding does work now for some of our audience, but we are still a podcast.
It is pleasing, though. Look, anybody who gets to the semis deserves to be there, but there are certain ideal scenarios that we have at the start of a tournament, and this is right up there.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, you want to be where you feel the sporting world's or the wider world's attention is, and ultimately that comes from names or people with interesting stories. And I felt that, you know, I was on centre court watching the Alcaraz match while on my laptop I had Eubanks, and I think Eubanks, that's a story that for us has done really well. Obviously there's the American angle, but that's had real cut through.
Good piece, by the way.
Thank you very much.
That.
Yeah, he's got a great story, he's got a great personality, and yeah, people can just really easily get on board with that. You've seen how the crowds react to him.
Yeah, I've had more messages from my casual tennis watching friends today about Christopher Eubanks than anybody else. I had a couple about Ons Jabeur, but Claire Balding just walked past us earlier to go and record the end of her BBC show, and she said, I'm gutted about Eubanks. Everybody had got so behind him, and he came so close today, David. He, in fact, even though he lost today, the stat came up, didn't it, over the course of the match, I think in the fourth set against Daniil Medvedev, that he has hit more winners at this Wimbledon than anyone in the history of Wimbledon. And I'm so glad he owns that stat, because that tells the story of his Wimbledon.
Incredible.
Doesn't it?
Really does.
He deserves to have it.
Yeah, and I was commentating on the third set of that, where he was just knocking Daniil Medvedev off the court. And there aren't that many people who can do that, because he's standing so far back, he's absorbing so much, the courts have slowed down, and yet he's playing 90s tennis out there, just slamming serves down, going for broke off forehand and backhand, and serving and volleying relentlessly. I think it's a massive testament to Daniil Medvedev that he didn't totally tailspin in that situation and lose. So, I mean, you know, just quickly on Eubanks, looking back, 2 years ago, he was 200 in the world. He's played four times here. He's never got through qualifying. A year ago, he lost to Lucas Rossell, who is 37. And it is 11 years since Rossell beat Nadal here. And that was his one and only result of note. And he beat Eubanks. Eubanks was about to retire, according to your piece, to go and be a commentator. And here he is. He's cracked it. And now he's going to get into all the biggest tournaments in the world, and people just love him.
Yeah, those biggest tournaments in the world are going to be better for having Eubanks in
them. He's brilliant, he is.
I thought that fourth set from Medvedev today was brilliant, because there was literally only one thing he could do, which was hold serve and wait and hope that Christopher Eubanks stops hitting blazing winners. And that's exactly what he did. I think he only lost a couple of points on serve in the whole set. He was teetering. He was on the edge. Yeah. As you said, he was having that discussion with the umpire. We very nearly tipped over the edge and saw the best or worst of Medvedev, depending on your perspective. But he managed to keep it together, and he got it into a tie break. And that was the moment where I do think his experience probably told. I think Eubanks' game slightly fell apart in that tie break. He, certainly on set point, he dumped a volley in the net, and then in the fifth set he didn't really have anything left. Eubanks, I think he was pretty much out of gas. But for Medvedev, this match was, I think, won in that fourth set, because that was a really precarious situation he was in against a player who was returning so well. That's the thing I found amazing about Eubanks in this match. We know he's got a great serve. He said, "I think of myself as a server," and I think he was really exploiting the Medvedev return position. It wasn't really working all that well. It was allowing Eubanks to close the net and serve volley, but Eubanks was returning so well, and that was keeping Medvedev on his toes in those first few sets. But Medvedev, very impressive to keep his cool, keep his calm, and just somehow get through it.
What do we think about the Medvedev return position on grass?
It's really interesting. Before that piece I did on Eubanks, one of the people I spoke to was Paul Anacone, and I asked him, what chance he have against Medvedev, and he said, well, one of the things where I think he'd have joy is the fact that Medvedev stands so far back. That gives someone like Eubanks an opening and the initiative, and it's basically saying, well, the match is going to be on your terms, ultimately. I mean, that generally is considered such a bad strategy on grass. Everyone I've spoken to before this piece I mentioned says what you don't want to do is give up the court, basically. That might work on other surfaces. You look at those players who typically are good on clay but can't do anything on grass, often that's part of the problem. They like to stand miles behind the baseline and just hit topspin forehands. He sort of has found a way to make it work, but I do think for those two sets it didn't help him, because it just let Eubanks dominate and dictate. I think what Medvedev did well is that Eubanks is so unconventional an opponent, and I think that's such a big thing for these players, and why so many of them struggle on grass, is they love to have things just so. They want to be able to hit line and length baseline shots all day, and that's why hard courts suit most of them well. You're not going to get weird bounces. Throw in then the odd weird bounce, you're playing Chris Eubanks, and that's why I think it was really impressive that Medvedev turned it around. But I don't know. He might say you need to do that to give yourself more time against such a big server, and ultimately I guess it paid off.
But he does it against all sizes of server.
Yeah.
He does, but he changed it. In sets 4 and 5, he stopped doing it. And it's the first time all tournament that I've seen him do that. And he actually warned line judges about standing a little bit forward, because he says, I'm going to hit you. In the first two sets, he was worried, genuinely worried about hitting them with his follow-through. And then in the fourth set and the fifth set, he started standing up towards the baseline. And it was a really interesting moment, because he's obviously just... whether he's had any conversation with the coach, I don't know what you thought, Matt, but I think he just realised, this isn't working, I've got to change.
Yeah, I think there was a time when we were really learning about Medvedev, where one of the key traits to his game was mid-match adjustments. And I think maybe we don't talk about that quite so much as we used to, just because we know his game a bit more. But yeah, he really made one in that fourth set. He didn't manage to break in the fourth set, but he put a lot more pressure on the Eubanks serve. I think it helped him just win one or two points in the tie break. And then in the fifth set, he absolutely sort of rolled through it. It sort of maybe took him a little while to figure it out, and he was perhaps a little fortunate that he did have that time to do it, but he really took advantage. And I think, honestly, that will be a factor in his next match against Carlos Alcaraz, because that was something I really remember from their match at Indian Wells, the way Alcaraz with his serve could just take Medvedev off the court and then either come in or hit a drop shot.
Yeah, the power drop shot combo was so effective against Medvedev and Indian Wells, and Medvedev knows that.
Yeah,
he will. I'm fascinated about how the mind of Medvedev tracks that and plans for the match on Friday, and whether Alcaraz tries to second guess that. I don't think so. I think Alcaraz just goes out there and says, "I'm Carlos Alcaraz."
And that drop shot is working so well on the grass. Just that low
so
bounce.
How close did Medvedev come today to breaking his pledge to the British public?
I did think that it's all well and good. It's very easy to be humble and gracious when you're doing well. Obviously, that becomes a lot harder. That goes out the window when it isn't. He just about held it together. I mean, I wasn't on court for that, so I don't know
and
how much...
Do we think maybe he hasn't come into press yet? We haven't had a chance to ask him. Was it the pledge he made to the public that stopped him from going over the edge?
Possibly.
I don't know if he's that rational. Yeah. I think once he's out there, I think he is a bit of... You know what Amin Resmo said about Andy Murray? She can never quite square who the person off the court and on the court. And I think there's a bit of that with Medvedev because he's such a lovely, charming, funny guy. He's one of my favourite people to speak to at press conferences. But on the court, things happen. Weird things happen.
He had a phrase in his press conference the other day. He was asked about that difference between on-court and off-court. And he said off-court, he's more kind of like whatever. He doesn't really let stuff affect him so much. But he described himself as hot-blooded on-court. He said, yeah, hot-blooded, that's a good phrase to describe how I am. And, yeah, I think Charlie's right. I don't think he can fully control how he's feeling and reacting on court. It was in French, the exchange that he had with Demian Dumasoir.
I think he felt a bit hard done to, actually. I think it was a batter way of the ball that hit the cameraman.
Yeah.
And he was given a code violation for unsportsmanlike conduct. And Demian Dumasoir quite sensibly turned off his mic at this point, so I couldn't hear what was going on. But the body language was one of interrogation almost of Medvedev to Dumasoir.
Yeah, Medvedev said something like, how are you talking to me? If you talk to me like that off court, we're going to see, or something. You know, it was kind of a little bit threatening in French. But it sounded like maybe they were reconciling at the end
they sort of exchanged words, didn't they?
Well, I was on centre court watching Alcaraz at Runa and watching this on a screen, as I say, without sound. I looked at my screen and topless Medvedev is sitting down at the chair having won the match, just gesticulating with Damien Dumasoir semi-naked. And apparently I'm told that that was them reconciling.
You're told it did happen, it wasn't like a weird fever dream.
I don't know, someone confirmed for me, did
no,
that
No, I was
happen?
Same thing. I was on centre, right. Out of the corner, where I just sort of, yeah.
They did have a protracted conversation, and by the end, Dumasoir was smiling as if, like, that made you feel like Medvedev had said a funny, and they'd probably got past it. I mean, Dumasoir is quite confrontational himself. Mm. He doesn't back down from
punchy
players, does he? He'll have a go back, and that sometimes winds them up more, but I also don't mind it, really.
Oh God, no!
I don't like to see umpires. Not that I'm not accusing Medvedev of this, but some players, and Kyrgios are accused of it. Some of them bully umpires, and I don't like to see that. Mm. I really hate it.
Same. So Medvedev against Alcaraz, because Alcaraz beat Holger Rune, a man, a couple of weeks his senior, maybe even less than that.
6 days.
Yeah. Both turned 20 in May of this year in three extremely competitive sets, particularly the first set. I thought Rune was the better player in that first set, and it was, I mean, this is incredibly reductive, but basically a double fault in the tiebreak.
A double fault in the tiebreak, but also an amazing point that Alcaraz played to get the early mini break, which to me just summed up why he is so different from all the guys that have come before him in the last 20 years to try and unseat the big three, big four, and that's the variety he has. He played a lob, then a drop shot, and then flicked away a backhand winner, moved him up to 2-1, having, as you said, he was second best. He didn't have a break point all first set. Rune only had one, but even so, just his ability to do stuff like that, he's just so creative. And I loved this match. I thought it was such a high standard. And Alcaraz, I think, is certainly the best I've seen him play this tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. I was so pleased with that first set and how well they were both playing, and it was actually Rune doing Alcaraz things. He was the one winning the fun points.
Mm.
He hit the drop shot lob. He hit the tweener. It wasn't a clean winner, but he ended up winning the point. And afterwards, he did a finger raise to the crowd. It was Alcaraz's greatest hits, having said in that clip that we talked about yesterday that he wouldn't take any of Alcaraz's game. Actually, he ended up mimicking quite a lot of it, and it was all just fantastic fun.
And I thought it was interesting that Alcaraz, having said that he would take Rune's backhand, I thought Alcaraz's backhand today was phenomenal, especially on return. It won him the first set with a winner past Rune, who was serve volleying, and it got him the crucial break in the second set to take him 5-4 up.
Another, which was his first break point of the match.
Yeah, he just leaned on it. And yeah, I think probably for me the biggest revelation about Alcaraz on grass has been that backhand. been so impressed by how compact it is and how he's able to flatten it out and not feel rushed on it. I think, yes, Rune's backhand is amazing, but I think Alcaraz's is really, really holding up on this surface and sort of complements the rest of his game, which is flashy and can, you know, can sort of take your breath away. The backhand is so, so dependable and reliable. Sorry, I'm just going on about Alcaraz and backhands. Two of my favourite things.
No, that's a surprise.
That lob, drop shot, passing shot combo, it's the sort of Alcaraz platter, mm-hmm. isn't it? Mm. Here's all the things I can do. Aren't they great?
Set me up for them.
Yeah.
It was smorgasbord.
It was a wonderful wrenching of momentum in that tiebreak. And then, the double fault and then a backhand down the line return winner from Alcaraz. Did he see that Rune was serve and volleying on set point, or did he think Rune's the type of guy that might do a slightly unwise serve and volley on set point here off a not great serve? I don't know, but what a shot.
I just felt as well during that match, and while Eubanks Medvedev was going on simultaneously, just I think there's been a big worry this tournament, you know, first one post Federer, no Nadal, and again I'm speaking as someone who's a huge tennis fan, so maybe I'm not the best gauge of this, but it did feel like these are two really fun matches that I do feel can captivate people, and that, you know, maybe the doom and gloom about where men's tennis is, that it's in safe hands. I mean, who knows where Eubanks will go after this, but Medvedev's not going anywhere, and as you say, Rune and Alcaraz only just turned 20, and the level they were playing at, you know, obviously we know about Alcaraz, but I was really impressed with Rune as well. That first set was just, it was like exhibition stuff, but in a way of just a really competitive exhibition match.
Yeah, I thought the difference was the experience golf today between Rune and Alcaraz, which is extraordinary given they're both 20 years old, but Alcaraz has got reps on the block at this stage of Grand Slams and major tournaments. I really believe in Rune on grass. I think it's there. I think he's good at getting down low. You know, he's got the Matt Roberts thing. I don't think he minds a low bouncing ball, and it's all experience for him. And it's a Grand Slam where he didn't fail physically. I think that's quite significant. He did have he played five sets in the previous round, didn't he? Well, two rounds ago. Two rounds ago.
Dimitrov,
and he bounced back from that well physically. I think that's significant for him in his development, and I expect him to be back here and be a threat in the future. And I saw enough today to continue my hype of that rivalry.
Yeah,
back
I think
me
so.
Up here, Charlie.
I think he'll take way more out of this than the French Open, where he also went out in the quarterfinal stage, but in a really weird.
Oh, let's not relive
that. This was never. I mean, like, this was
so
nothing
bad.
Like that.
Yeah.
Even though he actually won a set in that match.
Yeah, I mean, what a weird time.
He's going to be fine, I think. Yeah. I think this is.
Do you think he'll win majors?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Do you think there's a question mark over that?
No, I guess not. I mean, it's just so hard to say at this point when a player's that young. I mean, yeah, it feels like.
I feel very confident. And the reason I feel confident is because of how similar to Djokovic he is. Mm. And the fact that he's been able to beat Djokovic at his own game. Okay, not at a Grand Slam.
Yeah.
But these are embryonic stages of his career. He's so early in it all. I just think he's going to keep learning. Maybe the biggest concern for him would be burnout. Just the sheer amount he plays. If that can be managed, I think his appetite to learn and to improve, I just think he's going to keep getting better.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you. I agree with Charlie. You do never really know. I feel like we would have been absolutely sure that Tsitsipas would have won a major in 2019.
When Dimitrov in 2014.
Right. And
all right, Charlie, there's no need to go there.
I still worry a little bit about Rune physically over five. I think he will get there. I think he needs a big win in Slam. He hasn't really had one yet. He's still so young. He's been solid in
Slams. Beat Griggle.
Beat Davidovich Fokina.
Yeah, you know, I agree. He hasn't had that moment.
He hasn't quite had that moment yet, but I feel pretty confident that it's going to come. But
who do we feel more confident in, Rune or Sinner?
Oh, Sinner, I would say.
Oh, I was going to say Rune.
Really?
Yeah.
I think Rune has the higher ceiling. But just for who I would trust, who I think has the consistency and is kind of more there right now, I would say Sinner.
I think they both will, but I would go Rina David.
Do you think Sinner will win a Grand Slam?
I do. Curious. Yes, I do.
Is Djokovic going to have to retire to do for him to
yes.
do that?
I think so.
Interesting. What do you think, Matt, about those two? Sinner
and Rune. I think right now I'm probably with Charlie. I think Sinner's a little bit further along. But I think if I had to predict now, I'd say they will both win majors. I think Alcaraz is ahead of both of them, and I think we'll stay ahead of them. But if we're looking at players to take some of the slams that Alcaraz isn't going to win when Novak Djokovic is gone, yeah, I think Rune and Sinner do stand out.
What's Chris Eubanks going to do from this point?
This is so interesting. And again, with the interviews I did for that backgrounder on him, that was a question I asked, you know, because we've seen so many people have a breakout run at a slam. Might goes back to Aslan Karatsev, and who now of it that feels like a bit of a joke, but you know, he got to a Grand Slam semi-final, and there are so many, history is littered with those kind of players. Vladimir Volchkov at the 2001.
Alexander Pop.
He didn't get to of a course. Semi, did he?
Quarter.
Yeah, he got
the
to
same
quarter.
As Eubanks.
Yeah, that's true.
Don't trash my Alexander Pop knowledge.
I was still trying to think of the Vladiator from 2000. Vladimir Volchkov. Remember when
he was a qualifier.
Remember when his head was put onto the Gladiator's body in the early days of Photoshop.
It was that summer that the film came out, so there was that synergy. I remember that very vividly, him losing in straight sets to Sampras in the semi.
Yes.
Hang on, while you were working for the ATP at this time, and did you come up with that nickname?
No, I didn't. That was, you know who did, don't you?
Nope.
Bud Collins.
Oh, neckcord.
Yeah, the great Bud Collins came up with that nickname, and the tabloids ran with it, didn't they, Charlie?
It's great. I mean, I remember.
I don't know. He was about 12, probably.
Almost exactly, yeah. But that was when I was, completely obsessed. You know, during my Rozetsky phase, who lost to Vince Spadia in the first round that Wimbledon. You'll remember that.
He went through an official Rozetsky phase.
I do remember
the Spadia because that
was at the end of his losing streak.
Yes, he was on that awful losing streak.
21.
No, he lost to Spadia.
Yeah. So, but it was. So he ended his losing streak by facing Greg.
But it was a 21 match.
Oh, Spadia, you mean, was on losing streak. But wasn't Greg as well? Greg was in.
But Greg's not coming out well for this.
Remember that one? The Greg hype guy, Charlie. That's remember
that one where Greg. When was it that he started effing and blinding all
that
over
was 2003.
All over the tabloids.
Some wanker in the crowd. One of the greatest moments. I was on court.
The water
for
bottle one.
Well, there was
with
the Roddick one.
I was front row for that. I was
there as well. I queued before.
Guys.
Yeah.
I managed to stay awake for the whole match. Wow.
Yeah. Some wanker in the crowd.
sorry, Mom.
Was that either of you?
We didn't invite him. He just turned up.
Anyway. I've never told Greg this, but I was cheering for Andy Roddick that day.
Were you?
Mm. I'm seeing Greg tomorrow. I'll mention it.
That was when Roddick was.
Why weren't you cheering for Andy Roddick?
16-year-old girl or something. I don't know. You know. Sorry, Greg. Why am I confessing this on a live show? Who knows?
But we digress. I mean, Eubanks.
I forgot that.
The Gladiator and some wanker in the crowd.
He's going to have a good life now, isn't he? I mean, he's going to be in every draw.
Sure. And in terms of
the sense that everyone who knows him has is that he is a great learner. He's already made such strides. He's, you know, because he has admitted, you know, he's made mistakes like. Someone was saying to me that after one big win he was just up all night reading messages and whatever, as you would, totally understandable behaviour, but also completely frazzling, and he lost the next match. Then he sort of puts that behind him, is able to dial in. He's had big wins, couldn't back them up. Well, this tournament, he beat Cam Norrie. And, you know, it was said to me, he could have just done victory laps and celebrated that, been like, wow, what a year I've had, and I've just knocked out last year's semi-finalist, British number one. He didn't do that, won his next match, and then beat Tsitsipas. So he seems like such a great learner, someone who can process things. And the sense is that he'll be fine and will, you know, stay at this kind of level. But it will be really interesting because suddenly he's got a target on his back, and also people know how he plays. I think a big thing for him this tournament is that people are like, what is this guy doing? Why is he serve and volleying all the time? I just don't really know how to deal with this. Yeah, people don't have any data on it.
Remember when Misha Zverev had a little moment?
Yes. He was going to bring back serve and volley.
He was going to bring back serve
and volley. He was the saviour that tennis were looking for.
And it didn't... It all went a bit Maxime Cressy, didn't it?
Yeah.
Who is a future world number one, obviously.
All my faves just... getting trashed.
Well.
Including
again,
by me.
David, tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong. I actually think that Chris Eubanks knows what his game is. Reading your piece, that's something that really struck me, is that he's now figured out, who am I? Yeah. What sort of tennis player am I? And no matter how you prepare for it, if he executes it, it's hard to deal with. Is he good enough to keep executing it, is my question mark, because he spent years not winning very many matches. So we'll find out. Is this just a hot streak? It could be.
Is he going to go into the US Open? Let's say he doesn't do... Let's say, you know, he does okay in the lead-up to the US Open events. Is this run that he's been on now here at Wimbledon, is it enough for him to go into US Open as a big deal? Lots of media demands and...
Yeah.
He's going to be
hyped. Huge.
Yeah. I mean, bear in mind as well, he's, you know, he's so friendly with Coco Gauff, Naomi Osaka. He's a big deal. And even in Miami, he had, like, Jamie Foxx and other huge names cheering him on. He has that magnetism. I think the New York crowd are going to absolutely love him. I'm sure he'll... Well, I'm not sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was on a night match early on and... Because I think they realise this guy, just he has that cut through. He's got that magnetism.
Just needs to be good enough to kind of get a couple of wins as well.
Exactly. That doesn't guarantee that he'll win those matches. No. But I think he'll have the crowds massively behind him.
Charlie, seeing as we might not get to speak to you again, I'm going to ask you to go big on to make arbitrary predictions.
Please.
And resolutely stick to them, please. Yes. Who's going to make the finals and who's going to win those finals?
So it's going to be Djibir, Vondrosheva women's final that Djibir's going to win. And then it'll be an Alcaraz-Djokovic final that Djokovic will win.
Have you spoken to anyone this fortnight who doesn't think Djokovic is winning Wimbledon?
No. I can't remember.
Find someone.
Yeah.
That's a piece.
I might be changing my mind.
Because I at Roland Garros, after the first, I'll never forgive myself for this stupidity, but after...
we'll get to that.
We'll be coming back to that.
Carry on, Charlie.
No, I did the stupidest thing after watching, I think it was maybe the Davidovich-Fekina match, and I thought to myself, you know what, Djokovic is vulnerable here. He doesn't look that great. And then obviously it was just that thing he does where early on, and then he went and won it at a canter. So I think it's just so hard... It's so hard to bet against him. I don't know a single person. But I remember in 2016 when the famous Sam Querrey won, I remember feeling similarly confident. And I remember at that time, you could not find a single person who thought he wouldn't win it. So maybe he won't. But the problem is when he gets to this stage of the tournament.
Yes.
I mean, when did he last get this? He lost the final at the US to Medvedev. But generally...
And he lost... we lost the quarters last year, didn't he?
To Nadal. But that feels kind of a
separate...
Nadal Roland Garros. Yeah. But, you know, generally, once he gets deep...
David?
Explain yourself.
Well, I went Djokovic at the outset of the tournament. But I do think when you start seeing people play matches, you can develop a view that is different to that. And I think Alcaraz is getting better. And I think that they are going to meet in the final. And I do not think that Alcaraz is going to cramp in that final. Mm. So I haven't made up my mind completely yet. But...
Hang on, we all think it's going to be a Djokovic-Alcaraz final.
Yes. But I haven't made my mind up about who I think is going to win yet. You're going to have to keep a close eye on the newsletter.
Was that all just a big newsletter team?
No, it actually wasn't. I genuinely am starting to think that Alcaraz... might do it.
I do know what you mean. I did have a similar feeling on court today. The only thing with that is that it's so hard to evaluate someone relative to Djokovic until they actually play
when
them.
They're not playing Djokovic.
Exactly. Yeah,
remember that 2019 Australian Open semi-final? Nadal wipes the floor with Tsitsipas. I remember watching that being like, well, Nadal's obviously going to win this tournament because you can't play that well and not win it. And then you're like, oh, wait, there's a whole other level that's Djokovic.
But I now think that Alcaraz has got nothing to lose. really, in that final, when they face each other. Djokovic is going for the calendar slam. He's the man who's got something to lose. He's the favourite. Total turnaround from the French Open, where everybody thinks that it's Alcaraz who's going to take him out. Now he's had the cramping issue, and the assumption is, oh, he cramps when he gets in a tight situation, doesn't he? Well, yes, he did that time. Do we think that's going to be the case every time?
Do you think he's not going to cramp again?
No. He'll lose in
four
sets.
That was a one-time thing.
Do you think
it'll be four competitive close sets, but he'll lose.
Do you think Djokovic is more vulnerable with history on the line and going for that calendar slam? Or do you think he grows and gets better because of that?
I think both are possible, because I think if you look back on last year, or was it 2 years ago, when he came one match away from the calendar slam. He did grow, but he did hit a wall.
But at the US Open.
Yes, he did.
Spare a thought for Jannik Sinner in this conversation.
Yeah.
Daniil Medvedev.
Absolutely. And I think the beauty of the semi-final lineup is you could make a compelling argument for other results. I still think it'll be Djokovic-Alcaraz. I just think, look, all along we've been saying Alcaraz has got the game, the potential to beat even Djokovic. One day that's going to happen. Mm. One day it will happen.
For sure.
Yeah.
But 100%. When's the crossover? And can he do it when Djokovic is still kind of at his peak? I think it's possible, and I'm just not sure yet.
If he does it when Djokovic is at his peak on grass, I think that would be...
Yeah, if we're at the US Open right now, different chat.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, Sinner as well. You know, obviously, as we know, Sinner took two sets off him.
Yeah.
And no one's done that since Federer here in the 2019 final. So he clearly has a shot. But yeah, it'd be a huge surprise if he did win there.
Hubert Hurkacz,
he
got close in several sets.
He did.
And now we've had even Andre Rublev get in a set against him. And we're talking about actual Carlos Alcaraz in a final having won six matches to meet him.
I know, but is that a little bit like me with Davidovich-Fokina saying, well, Davidovich-Fokina should have won?
No, it's nothing like it.
It feels to me like 06, 07, 08 Federer-Nadal finals. You know he's going to get there. And maybe Alcaraz won't have to do the 06. It'll just be 07, 08.
I think that's very well said.
Happening.
Highly possible.
This is the matchup. These are the best two.
Yeah.
You're going to take over eventually, but I'm going to try and hold you off for a bit.
I could absolutely believe
that.
And
like 06, it'll be a
four set
win for the favourite.
Some doubles results for you today. Storm Hunter and Elisa Mertens are through to the women's doubles semi-finals, as are Marie Buzkova and Sara Cerebes-Tormo. They've put French Open controversy behind them.
minds, they have.
We have quite a lot of messages when we've said how lovely Marie Buzkova is.
Yeah.
In the men's doubles quarterfinals today, Kevin Kravitz and Tim Puets, the 10 seeds.
Puts.
Oh my
god. Otherwise,
gosh.
My mum will be messaging you.
Sorry, Pat Roberts. They defeated Jamie Murray and Michael Venus. And we had another men's doubles. We had Marcel Granollers, Horacio Zaballos go through to the semi-finals as well. And Wesley Kuhlhoff, Neil Skubsky, they're the top seeds through to the semis. Big tournament for them, this, because they've been, for the last year and a half, the team to beat on tour, haven't won a slam. They haven't done it at slams, and they're into the semis now. I don't want to pile on too much pressure, but feels like this could and should be the moment, maybe.
And they beat a tennis Adam today.
Adam Pavlicek.
Who we were desperately searching for yesterday. He was right there in front of us in the doubles quarterfinals.
My goodness, there is one!
Matej Pavic and Ludmila Kichanok made their way through to the mixed doubles final. We had mixed doubles semi-final action today. There's been boys and girls stuff going on. Matt will do some talent spotting over the course of this week and we'll bring you news from that. Charlie, you might be able to get out to court number one. Oh no, it's just ended. But
what was the final score?
Greg Rozetsky and Conchita Martinez defeated Thomas Enquist and Anki Ottavong 7-5, 3-6, 12-10.
Wow.
Thriller.
He's still got
still
it.
Still got it.
You'll be tweeting that later.
Yeah. And that is a revenge. Well, not a revenge. What is it? Greg and Anne were a team last year. They were paired together. last year. So potentially awkward in the locker room. Who knows? Right. I think that's just about your lot for today, except to tell you about Erin, our lovely Wimbledon mascot. Hello, Erin. Hey. Our mascots. David's got Maisie. Have you, Maisie?
Maisie, you and me. Nailing it.
I've got Xenia, and Matt has got Darwin. No.
It's going so badly.
Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. And Matt, we have shout-outs.
We have Hannah Alexander from Cambridge.
Like Hannah, our executive producer, and Hannah Wilkes, shout-out to Hannah, in the chat right now and on our Twitter, doing heroic work all day, every day.
Yeah.
Thanks, Hannah. All Hannahs, all Hannahs.
And Cambridge, great place.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Duchess of Cambridge made a splash here in the first
week.
Very
good. Thank you, Hannah. Mm.
We've also got Noreen Riley from New Jersey.
Right, Noreen.
Like Bruce Springsteen.
Yes, we are in the company of someone who went to see Bruce Springsteen this week.
You had night two at Hyde Park, right?
I said when Wimbledon was put on the Athletics radar, I said that's fine, but the first Saturday I will be at Bruce Springsteen.
You didn't get Thunder Road.
Unlike you two. Didn't get Thunder Road, yeah.
Or the River.
No.
Do you feel okay about that?
We got Darkness and Twist and Shout at the end was fun. I was gutted about Thunder Road also because I was just like, this is an app. It didn't even cross my mind that we wouldn't get it. But it was great.
I'm trying to make myself feel better about the fact that we need to sell our tickets.
Yes,
We tried to put our foot down.
I made objections.
Anyway, hope you're enjoying the live shows, guys, because
the sacrifices we have made.
Honestly.
It's all worth it.
Thank you, Noreen.
Yeah, thanks, Noreen.
And finally, we've got Lauren and Christian Rootberg from Malibu, California.
Wow.
Well, hello, Lauren and Christian. Like Christian Rude.
Yes.
Christian Harrison.
Yes.
That's second Harrison brother to get
Who Christian Harrison played doubles with Chris Eubanks at the US Open when Eubanks made his debut.
This is knowledge off the scale.
Christian Harrison is married to somebody in tennis. Or Ryan Harrison is married to someone's sister.
One of the two.
Someone's brother is married to someone's sister. I feel like Madison Keys might be involved somewhere. Anyway. No, maybe
imagine
not.
If she's not.
I think we might have
met. She's going with Frontangelo.
No, no. Madison Keys isn't married to anyone.
Okay.
Anyone
Bjorn Frontangelo.
Yeah, Bjorn, what's it?
But not a Harrison. Yes.
No, but someone's sister is married to someone's brother. Anyway, Christian and Lauren. Like Lauren Davis, who almost beat
Jessica Pegula.
Mm.
And I think we might have met Lauren and Christian at Indian Wells this year because they said in their shout-out thing that we hope to run into you in person at Indian Wells so we can discuss with David how Luisa Stefani truly is some player. And I remember having that conversation.
Thank you, Lauren and Christian.
Thank you, Lauren and Christian.
Validation.
And also, thank you to Cheryl on our chat, who points out that Ryan Harrison is married to Christina McHale's sister. but she also points out she doesn't know if that information is current.
That's nearly good knowledge. Definitely a good lead.
Thank you to all of our shout-out friends, to our intro friends, to our friends. We are very grateful to you being our friends and for supporting this podcast year round. Charlie, we're very grateful to you for being here. David's plugged the newsletter enough tonight, so I won't do that again, but do subscribe to the newsletter. It is free and the link is in our show notes, as is the link to become a friend. Leave us an Apple Podcast review. Please hit like and subscribe if you're enjoying the show on YouTube, and tell your friends, please. Not us, friends, like your actual friends. Yeah. And we will see you and speak to you here live from Wimbledon tomorrow.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.